thoughts that he puts into our minds in and of themselves are not sin, but they lead to sin. And that's why they're so subtle. They're so sneaky. Disappointment, discouragement. And when you're discouraged or disappointed, rather, the things fail to come up to your expectations. Or you say, I deserve better. And that in itself is not sin. But when you get that attitude, you're certainly open for the next steps. Now, I want to turn back to Job and show you the things we said last time are all there. And in the first place, you have Satan behind the scene in the book of Job, clear to the end, until Job gets well. And it's because if you look at the first verse, and you notice in first chapter in the 12th verse, you have the Lord allowing Job to come under Satan's full authority, full power, to do what he wanted to do. And so the Lord said unto Satan, behold, all he has is in your power, in your power, your ability. Only upon himself put not forth thy hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. Now he destroyed Job's property. Now what I wanted to, and why I saved it tonight, you can see that Satan is creating circumstances. Don't ever go by circumstances if you're depending on the Lord's leading. The Lord always brings circumstances after you determine to follow the Lord's leading. You determine to go to seminary, and then the Lord brings circumstances. It's not that there are circumstances prior, and that's why a lot of fellows out there beating the woods should be in seminary or not. They're waiting for circumstances. But that's not the way you do it. Now, if Job looked at circumstances, you see, or God's will, he would have been disappointed, and he was. Now, you see that, and then look over in the second chapter, and you'll notice now God allows him to touch Job. And in the sixth verse, second chapter, and Jehovah said to Satan, behold, he is in thy hand. He's under your power, but don't you take his life, but you save his life. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Now you see again circumstances. By taking Job's health, he changed the circumstances. Believe that changed your circumstances, you think again. So circumstances can be brought about by Satan. Now he did it for the purpose, first, of disappointing Job. And sure enough, look at the third chapter and notice Job's first reaction to these new circumstances. Notice all through this chapter, he wishes he hadn't been born. He wishes if he had been born, he'd have died at the point of his birth. Now that's disappointing. That's saying life does not live up to my expectation. I am glad. I wish I never lived it. And I'll read just a few verses and you can see it. Third verse, let the day perish wherein I was born, the night in which it was said, a man-child is conceived. He says, even the night of my conception, I wish it never happened. And if you look down through there, you can see the ninth and tenth verse, let the stars of the twilight thereof be dark, let it look for light, but have none, neither let it see the dawning of day, because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid the sorrow of my eyes. Why died I not from the womb? Why wasn't I born, a stillborn? You see, here's the cry of a man. Of course, he's in the Old Testament. And his circumstances are getting him down. But who brought the circumstances? Who brought them? Satan. Not God. God permitted. Remember, God never tempts you, but he does permit you to be tempted. All right, and so Satan, now there you have a disappointment. It's so blatantly easy to see. Disappointment. Look over at the seventh chapter and the 15th verse through the 17th verse. And notice, he saves the poor from the sword and from their mouth and from the hand of the needy. So the poor hath hope and iniquity stops her mouth. Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, despise thou not the chastening of the Almighty. Now, that was the advice given to him by one of these friends was wrong. You see, it wasn't God chastening him. So sometimes the circumstances are created by friends. man said something wrong. It says so in the last chapter. Job, you'd ought to always read the last chapter first, like a detective story, and then you find out who done it. And anything these three men said, you just wipe it clean. You know that they're all fouled up. But you see here, he's using friends to discourage Job. And that can work, too. Now let's look at discouragement, when you say God has forgotten all about me. He's forgotten all about me. I can't find him. He's not around. He's forgotten all about me. And you have just chapters loaded with it. If you look at the 9th chapter, he says, even if I could find God, what would I say to him? You see? Because I'm a man, and who can contend with God? So he says, 9th chapter, Job is talking. I know it is so of a truth, but how shall a man be righteous with God? If he will contend with him, he cannot answer one in a thousand. God asked him 1,000 questions, he couldn't answer one of them. He's wise in heart and mighty in strength, and who's hardened himself against him and hath prospered. And it goes on down through here, tells you how God created the different solar constellations, and yet God has withdrawn from Job, and Job cannot find him. So he comes to the end of the chapter and says, well, what I really need is an umpire. That word daysman, an umpire. Somebody to stand between me and God. If I can't find God, God's deserted me. I can't answer God if he asks me something. I need somebody standing between. Now, Job didn't have the answer. He didn't know who that daysman would be. He never got him. It didn't happen until the incarnation. We live in the dispensation where we have a daysman, a mediator, one standing between God and us. I see there, Job. He said, God's forgotten all about me. In the 19th chapter, I think it is, he says, I've tried to find God. I wanted to find him, but I can't find him. Let me see if it's in that chapter. Yeah. Look at the 19th chapter in the 7th verse. It says, I cry out of wrong, but I'm not heard. God doesn't hear me. I cry aloud, but there's no judgment. God didn't step in and change this thing that's unrighteous. I didn't do anything to deserve this, Job is saying, and he was robbed. He didn't. He was getting the most privileged position any man in the whole Bible ever had. He had the privilege of vindicating God's person to Satan. Satan had made an accusation that Job served God because God paid him. And he said to God, you take away what you're paying Job, and Job will curse you to your face. But Job never cursed God to his face. He says, come out of it. And he never knew it, apparently, until after it was all over. He says, God isn't around. He doesn't hear me. He doesn't step in and correct things that are wrong. And you can see that back there, this man's living at the time of Abraham, just before Abraham, between the splitting of the continents and Abraham. And God did step in, appear personally to right wrongs. As the angel of Jehovah, you see? And he could expect that. That's how Abraham got his revelation. God appeared to him at least 7 times personally, corrected things, straightened things out. Right? And so it is. Now the next step is always doubt. You see, if you think you deserve more than you're getting, and if you think God has forgotten you and is not righting the wrongs coming your way, then what is the next step? Doubt. And if you do something doubting, doubt itself is not a sin. 90% of the pulpits will preach on Sunday morning, if you doubt, you sin. Doubting is not sin. But the next step, when you doubt, then do something. There's where Satan gets you, see? So here are 3 things that Satan brings by manipulating circumstances, by bringing circumstances, and any will he does today. He hadn't lost that power. He can make your bill collectors hard-hearted, and yet they take it easy on everybody else. Sure, that's happened. Bill collector finds out that you're a Christian, and he takes it harder on you because you're supposed to pay up. And he'll take it easy on the rest of them. And the circumstances can make it rough. Right now, disappointment, discouragement, and doubt. So it's at the point where there's doubt, if you do anything, then it becomes sin. Do a harmless thing, a thing that I can do, and it's not sin to me if I do it without doubting. And you do it doubting, it's sin to you. Then if you copy me and doubt while you're copying me, then what you do then is sin. That's the whole point of Romans 14. Don't stumble the younger brother. if you eat meat and he thinks it's wrong to eat meat, but he eats meat because you're eating meat, but he's doubting while he's eating it, you're making him sin. You're stumbling him. That's the whole point of the last few verses of Romans 14. You see? All right, so here's where sin comes in. Now, you see, this seems almost harmless. We get out of it as Christians and say, well, I like to gripe once in a while. What's griping? It's another word for objecting to your lot or your relationship to the Lord. And it's nothing in the world but good old disappointment or discouragement. One or the other, depending on your type of gripe. Of course, we like to change things. We worry and we say we don't worry, we're anxious. That's all right. See, if you say anxious, that's okay. To worry, that's bad. You're disappointed, discouraged, that's bad. But you can gripe. Bellyache is another term for it. But all Christian bellyaching and griping is really a result of this. What did we just read? If you really realize your relationship to Christ, be content with such things as you have. If you're content, you don't gripe. I've never seen a contented person gripe yet. I never have. Well, these football players get their thousands of dollars. They're not going to gripe after that. They're griping now. When they're contented, they won't gripe. All right? And so, a Christian that's content with such things they have won't be a griping Christian. But a griping Christian is one that's skating on thin ice because Satan is giving them lust and they don't even realize they've got lust. You see? They're up, they're going to doubt, and then they're going to sin, or they're going to act independent of God. Now, that's another one that most Baptists are guilty of. You'll see it especially at Baptist business meetings. They go through a whole business meeting, plan something, and get through at the end. They say, God bless it. You ain't going to be embarrassed, God, if you don't bless it, because we're going to do it anyway. You ever heard that? They didn't ask God beforehand. They didn't depend on the leading of the Holy Spirit beforehand. It all through. And then they say, God bless it. And it's kind of putting God on the spot, you know. You're going to do it anyway. And if he doesn't bless it, well, he'll be an embarrassed God because he didn't bless what you're going to do, but you're going to do it anyway. Well, that's nothing in the world but independence of God. And most Christians act that way 6 days a week. They get up in the morning. They go to work like God didn't exist. They come home like God didn't exist. They wait till Wednesday night, the good Christians, and they come to prayer meeting, and then God exists for a little while. And then they go home, get up Thursday morning, go to work like God doesn't exist, goes through Saturday, and then Sunday they put on their good clothes and come to church, and God's finally there. Now, this is, I should have put it up, but I put it last so that I could wiggle it around where I want it. But independence of God, again, acting, thinking that you want to be independent of God or thinking in those realms is not sin. It's when you do something. Now, I want to show you what Satan did. That was his sin, wanting to be independent of God, but what he did with the woman. You see, background of Genesis 3, God used to come down daily and tell Adam and Eve what to do, what would bring happiness for the next day. Now, the word good there means that which would bring happiness. There was no sin at that point, so it wasn't the difference between sin and non-sinning. And he told them what would bring calamity. That's the word evil. It's raw. It's not a moral evil. It's a calamitous thing. And so Satan says to the woman, in effect, if you'll eat of this fruit, you won't have to wait for God. You won't have to depend on God. You'll know the difference between good and evil. Now, good and evil doesn't mean moral and immoral. Doesn't mean sin and not sin. It means that's which brings happiness, and that's which will bring calamity. You pull up too many of the fruit trees, you'll have calamity because you can't eat any fruit for a while. You see? They didn't have weeds, so they didn't have to weed yet. But they did have to prune the trees. And you know, sometimes, you ever seen somebody prune a tree so it looked like it'd never grow? Right? Well, Adam had to learn, you know. He wasn't born with a pruning book in his hand, because he's never born in the first place. And learn, he had to be taught. Now, when I want you just to look at two things. We don't have time to go into all of this, because there's a lot of phony things said about this temptation. You get most of it in anthropology. Satan didn't add to the Word of God. He did question, and Eve had not heard this from God. She had heard it from Adam, because she was created later in the day when God gave these orders to Adam. And so there's a lot of tommy rot. But let's look at what he said in the fifth verse of Genesis 3. For God does know that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as God himself. Now, mark out the little G-O-D-S. There were no such thing as idols at this point in time. There was no flesh that would respond to idols. Eve would have been appalled at idols at this point in time. There were no false gods at this point in time. This is the word Elohim. And it should be translated capital G-O-D. Now I can prove it to you because you look over in the third chapter and the 22nd verse, and God is ascertaining what had happened after Adam and Eve ate of this fruit. And he's ascertaining it by looking at the man because of the way the man ate it, the attitude, the motives. And so it says, and Jehovah God said, behold, Adam is become as one of us to know good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand and keep on taking of the tree of life and keep on eating and live forever, I'll kick him out of the garden so he can die. It's a real favor on God's part to kick him out of the garden so he'd die 930 years later, because normally, until the rapture, a person has to die to reach their future tense of salvation. So it's really grace on God's part. If Adam was still alive physically, he couldn't have his future tense salvation. He couldn't even have it because he wouldn't be part of the church. He'd be in a mess. We'd be raptured and he'd be left. What would we get? Well, he couldn't join the church. He was, all right? And so you have here independence of God. Now, it's expressed over in the New Testament in a very frank way, and people cannot read because they can't see what's being done here. There was an actual act, and it says, do. So if you look at James 4, I want you to see something here. Here is a man acting like the usual Baptist. He's making a whole year's plan and not taking God into the plan to begin with. Now, notice what it says in James 4:13. Go to now. This is just an expression saying this is sure foolish, or isn't this a dumb thing? Go to now. You that say, today or tomorrow, we will go. Now, underline the word go, actual go, into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Now, you see, they plan something that in itself is not immoral. It's not immoral to move your residence and to try to get profit, if you get it honest. There's no dishonesty here. So it's not an immoral situation. It's a situation any Christian could go through if he goes through it correctly. But what's left out here? Notice, you say, today or tomorrow, we will go, and we will continue in a certain city for a whole year, and we will buy, and we will sell, and we will get gain. Now, what's missing? God. Now, let's look down. You'll see it. Whereas you know not what shall be on tomorrow. For what is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little, then vanishes away. For you ought to say. Now, when you say this, it means to do it. The saying here just doesn't mean. I'll give you an illustration. I went to Bible Institute with a fellow. And I didn't know beans from butter, really. When I got saved, we got saved, and 4 months later, we moved to San Diego. We tried to find a church that taught the Word and couldn't find one. We stumbled. There was a gospel hall right downtown, and we found out, and it really cooked us for a while. It was the Seventh-day Adventist meeting on Sunday to make converts to tell people they shouldn't meet on Sunday, they should meet on Saturday. Now, here I'm a young Christian. That's what I run into, see? All right. So anyway, finally run into some group, and we'll go to Bible Institute. Now, I don't know anything. And here's some guy, he'd say, well, I guess I'll go to town. D.V. And I kept that up for about 6 weeks, and I kept wondering who D.V. was, you know. Well, it's the Latin for Lord willing. And so to him, it just became a little formula, a little nonsensical thing he would say. It didn't mean a thing to him. It was just something he said. And knowing him, it didn't really mean it. He was quite a character. Well, anyway, this doesn't mean just say it. It means when you say it, do it, and you can prove it from the next thing you say. Here's what it says. You'd ought to say, if the Lord wills. Now, that's the first thing you should take into account before you move to this city and try to get gain. If the Lord wills. What's the second thing? If we're alive. Interesting, isn't it? You don't know whether you're going to be alive. There's not a one of you here that could absolutely guarantee me 100% we'll all be alive tomorrow. So I've had funerals from anybody from 3 months up to 90 years. I know they die all ages. And they die young of strokes, as of Grace. She died of a stroke. 52 years old.
Men die at 20 years of age of a heart attack.
Everybody thinks when we get old folks like that, then we're going to die.
Then why do I have funerals for young people?
One to each person, that's all. And nobody knows the day. That's what he says here. You should first say in your planning, before you do anything, if the Lord wills, then if I'm alive, then what? Then we'll do. Now underline the word do. You see, it's not a sin until you actually do it without. Do this or that. Now notice the conclusion of it. The conclusion. But now ye rejoice in your boastings. All such rejoicing is evil. Therefore to him that knoweth to do, underline do again, not think. You actually say something and go and do it, but independent of God, then it's sin. See? See the word do there several times? That's a verb to do, poia. Oh, it means to actually do something, not think. It's never used of thinking, never once used of a mind. Therefore, him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not. Now, what's it do good in this verse? To take God into your planning before you do anything. That's what doing good is. It. To him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. To him. It could be sin to you and not to me. You see that? Because I may do the same thing as you do and take God in my planning before I do it. And I've not sinned, and you have. You see it? It's one of those things like doubting. It's not sin until you do it. But Satan is the one that gets you to act that way.
Oh, you can figure this out. You don't need any help. You're the smartest thing that God ever put on earth, you know. Oh, look at what you've accomplished.
Huh? And you do something without taking God into account. Now, it's odd. Many Christians are sinning and don't even know they're sinning, and then they call things sin that are not even sin. And so Christians are so cotton pick and mixed up, they don't know whether they're coming or going. They'll call pride sin, they'll call doubt sin. And yet they'll turn right around and do what this says and sin and not even know they're sinning. You see? Underline the word do three times there. It's not think. It's poieo's never used of think. And it assumes that when the fellow says, I'm going to go, he goes and does it. See? But before you go and do it, you should say, if it's the Lord's will. Now that means you should determine whether it is or isn't. You don't go if it's not, obviously. That's sensible. That's understood in the context. Then if I'm alive, those are safe things. But if you do it, and it can be a harmless thing. Do you see a harmless thing up there? I'm going to go to this city. I'm going to move to Portland. I'm going to set up an insurance business and make some profit. There's nothing immoral about that, is it? Most important factor out for a Christian. We sing a couple songs here day by day, moment by moment. That's the whole thing. God wants to be a part of your life. He doesn't want to be pinned on the end. You say, I'm going to do it. May God bless it. If you don't, you're going to be sort of embarrassed because I'm going to do it. It's going to turn out good. You see what it says? It says to him, this individual, nobody else. To him it is sin. Because his circumstance will always be different than my circumstance in which I do it. Independence of God. That's acting like God doesn't exist. He doesn't want to be part of your plan. Hey, I'm telling you, the problem with a Christian is God is right here. This is the temple of God. And I've got to live every day like I'm aware that he's there. And when I snub him, act like he's not there, then I act independent. And it's foolish, isn't it? It's almost as foolish as acting like you don't have a heart. Right now, you see in themselves, those don't seem bad, do they? None of these things are the immoral things everybody puts on Satan's doorstep. How do we know that these are Satan? Well, we saw Satan in Genesis 3. We saw Satan behind Job in Job, you see? And James 4 is just a continuation of Genesis 3. And Satan's right behind it. But it'll make you sin and make you just as carnal as if you became immoral. Today, people think immorality is worse than you could, or murder. Everybody's got their pet sin. But you know, you look at the Ten Commandments. Immorality, stealing, and murder came way down the line when God put the Ten Commandments. The first few dealt with things that God thought was important. Don't have any other God before Him. Don't make idols and worship them instead of God. God says that's more important than these other things. And yet we try to do them, act independent of God. Oh, there's nothing wrong with that. I've been to a lot of Baptist business meetings like that. I was at one where they had police officers to keep peace, and you know good and well they weren't asking God to bless it first and following the Lord's leading before the business meeting. They got all through. They said, "Now, Lord, bless what we're going to do." Independence of God. And I thought, boy, they're sinning and they don't know it. And I suppose if I'd have walked up there and told the moderator I was invited in as a spectator, they thought they invited about a dozen pastors in, as well as having the police there. They thought it'd calm things down. They thought there was going to be real bloodshed. But I suppose if I'd have walked up to the moderator afterwards and said, "You sinned," he'd have probably had me arrested. No, they do. All right, so you have acting independent of God. And it's just as much a sin to the individual as when he does something when he's doubting. And the funny part of it is, a person that's in right relationship to the Lord can do the very same things they're doing and not sin. Well, they don't plan it without God, obviously. You see, but they're doing exactly the same thing. They could be walking side by side and look like they're doing the same thing. But one thing, this fellow took God into his planning, the will of God. The other guy didn't. They're doing exactly the same thing. This guy's sinning. This guy's not. Here's a fellow that's eating something he doesn't doubt. He's not sinning. This guy's eating the same thing, but he's doubting. And he's sinning. Hard thing for most Christians to understand. Because they think sin is some boogie monster out there and it pounces on everybody and looks the same and acts the same and everybody does the same. That's not true. He gets Christians to do more of this stuff than anything else. And it's just as effective in ruining their Christian life as he had them to act immoral. I hope you understand. Or become drunks. It ruins their Christian life. They can't be spiritual and do that. They can't be spiritual. Not once you sin, until you get in right relationship again. All right, now you have that from Satan. Now the next thing is cowardice in spiritual things. Many times in spiritual things, it's not just witnessing to the unsaved. It's sometimes pastors accommodate the truth because they're scared. I got a bad name. I've never done that. I won't do it. But some will weaken the truth, accommodate the truth, compromise the truth. I've seen it many times. A fellow know that there's people in the room. I saw it in the CBA when they had a big premillennial fight for 4 years. There was a compromising truth because they knew their guys get mad if you say something. Cowardice. It's cowardice in spiritual things. And it's a shame. Now that comes from Satan too. I want you to turn, if you will, to Luke 22. And here you have the perfect example of it. Have you ever wondered why, you know, all of the were denying him by their absence, if you want to say it that way, but verbally, only Peter denied Christ. And it was not his intention. I'm sure if you would talk to Peter right at the point we're going to look at him in Luke 22, he said, "No, I'll die." And I'm sure when he said that, he wasn't idly boasting. But it was before Satan attacked him with timidity or cowardice. And all of a sudden he changes his tune. Now let's look, because starting with the 31st verse. 31st verse, and I'm going to show you the play on pronouns. Now in the English, they've tried to distinguish here for you, because the "you" that you find in italics there, which is, should be there, it's there by implication, is a plural, "you." And when he says "thee," that's the singular. That's the singular "you." In the Greek, you could spell it different. The singular "you" is spelled different than the plural "you," and you see it immediately. In English now, we don't even try to do "thee" and "thou," or like they did in Old English. We just say "you, you, 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 you." Down south, they say "y'all." That's different. All right? Now look. He said, "The Lord said, Simon, Simon." Now, Simon is is Peter. It's his other name. It was his name before he met Christ. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you. Now that you is plural. All of you apostles. He wanted all of you apostles, that he may sift all of you like wheat. Now you know how wheat was sifted in those days. You put it on the floor and you stomped it. Then you picked it up and like that. And boy, that meant really work them over. You get sifted like wheat. When you got through, you knew you had something. And that's a picture of what Satan wanted to do to them. Now, in essence, Christ said, I'm not going to let him have 10 of the apostles. I'm going to let him have you, Peter. But I prayed for you. Now, let's look at it, because you changed the pronouns. But I had prayed for you, singular, you, Peter, that your faith fail not. And when you turned around, the word convert never means saved. It means turned around, and Christians should get turned around when they're turned wrong. Today we use it for evangelism, and it's a misuse of term, just like they're misusing discipleship. Right? But this is saying, when you're turned around, and when he's turned around, you strengthen your brethren. Now here's what Peter says in this. He said to him, Lord, I'm ready to go with you to prison and to death. And I'm sure if you could have looked in Peter's heart at this moment, he was telling exactly the truth as he saw it. But he was telling it before Satan put something else in his heart. A little bit of cowardice. Now what's the result of Satan sifting Peter? Peter is going to be the one that's verbally going to deny Christ, and none of the others deny Christ because Satan does not sift them as wheat. And he made him a coward. I have a verse telling you that that doesn't come from the Spirit of God, it comes from another spirit. If you look over in 2 Timothy, and you have another man that's playing the coward. He sees Paul in prison. He stopped evangelizing because he said Paul got in prison because of it. This is the second imprisonment of Paul, not the first, as you read of in the book of Acts. And so he's clammed up, this man Timothy. He stopped using a gift that Paul had given him by laying on of hands. Timothy had two gifts, unusual. He got one when he got saved. He got one when Paul laid his hands on him. Now, I want to start with the sixth verse, and you'll see what I'm talking about. He's talking to Timothy. He says, wherefore I put you in remembrance that you stir up the gift from God, of God is from God, which is in you through the intermediate agency of the putting on of my hands. Now Paul says, when I put my hands on your head, after you were saved, in front of a whole bunch of preachers, you got a second spiritual gift that you're not using now. Now it's obvious that Timothy was filling in at a church as a pastor because he's an apostle. He was using his apostolic gift. But he wasn't using another gift. It tells you what it is down the eighth verse. There's witnessing for the Lord. That's an evangelistic gift. That's why in the fourth chapter he told Timothy to do the work of evangelism. Preacher all over the world to do that. All right? That's harsh language, but goes to the fourth chapter of 2 Timothy. He says he's got to do the work of evangelist. So he starts herding goats instead of shepherding sheep. And that's why the church is in the mess it's in today. Yeah, that's why the church is in the mess it's in today. They become goat herds instead of shepherds. And find the goats more important than the shepherds. Because they're to do the work of evangelism. No, that says Timothy do the work. Because he had the gift to do it. That makes sense, doesn't it? How'd you like it if I got up and told you, do the work of a plumber? Would you throw up your hands? Yeah. Why? Because you're not a plumber. You're not equipped to be a plumber. You see? He could tell Timothy to do the work of an evangelist because he was equipped to do it. All right? That's simple enough. My name's not Timothy. I never read my name in there. Now notice, he tells him, for God, why has Timothy stopped using that spiritual gift? He's going to explain it. The seventh verse has an explanation of why Timothy hadn't and wasn't using that gift. And he says, for God has not given us a spirit of cowardice. Now that word is dilea, not phobos. Phobos is the word we get phobia or fear from. This is dilea. This is the word for cowardice or timidity. Now this is what the verse is, what's called an ellipsis. And you can see it from the sense reading it, but I'm going to change it so you can really see it. But he has given us the spirit of power and love and a sound mind. See, that's an ellipsis. It's so apparent he didn't put the word spirit twice. Paul does that many, many times. He hasn't given us a spirit of cowardice. Now he's telling us that cowardice comes from a spirit that's outside of us, like the Holy Spirit that he's given us, which is inside of us. All right? So he says, don't even begin to be ashamed of witnessing concerning our Lord, or me, his prisoner. That's what Timothy was cowardly concerning. I don't blame him. They took him right after he got this letter. They pulled him out in the front of the place where the church met and beat him to death with clubs. That's why he was scared. It was a rough time there, but he turned against Paul, 15th verse. Even Paul wouldn't have found a friend at Ephesus if he had come back there at that point. Everybody turned against him. Now, this is the second imprisonment, not the first one that you find in the book of Acts. The reason they turned against him, because the Roman government is persecuting Christians. If you harbor a Christian, you die. And so, stay away from my door. Stay away. You see here a spirit of cowardice. We haven't got that kind of a spirit, Timothy. Now, if you'd look at 1 Peter 5, you have the perfect statement, if you understand what a lion does. And we don't have to turn out of the Bible to find what a lion does. And you have a simile here. The first thing you know when you read this, 1 Peter 5, verses 8 and verse 9. The first thing you know, that's the devil is not a lion, because there's a simile here. A simile as. And so he says, be sober. Now this means take it seriously. Take it serious that Satan is your enemy. You know, that's important today, because Satan's a joke today. Flip Wilson is a joke. Flip Wilson does something, everybody laughs like fun, and then he says, Satan made me do it. And they laugh again. He's a joke. You find him in the cartoons. In your magazines, this McCall family circle, there's cartoons. Satan's a funny one. I just pulled an article out of Newsweek magazine. And two pages on, well, let's see, I didn't bring it, I guess. The fact that they have thought Satan was a joke up at this time, and some people are starting to take him serious. So they're trying to determine who and what Satan is. But they try to determine everywhere but from the Bible. And so Satan's a joke. No, God says, be sober. That means serious-minded. Take it serious. Then be vigilant. Be on your toes looking for those lusts from Satan. Heard of vigilantes? Vigilant. Vigilantes, they were looking for people causing troubles, and then they eliminated them, remember? But they were on their toes watching for it. So vigilant means on your toes. Be serious about this. Satan can trip you up. And it seems so innocent. Haven't you got a right to gripe? Haven't you got a right to plan something? You're smart. You got an IQ of 150. It seems so innocent. But you can sin just as deadly and make you just as carnal as you drank a gallon of booze. Make you the same. Be sober. Be vigilant. Because your adversary, he's your enemy. See, you better take him seriously. He's your enemy. Your adversary. You don't invite them to dinner. Even as Christian, you're a fool if you do. I know what it says in the Gospels, but that's the difference. It's enemy to dinner. You might slip a Mickey in your beef roast. See, you try to reconcile. If you want, then you recognize that. See, the devil, like a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may overwhelm. Now, that word devour can mean eat up. Obviously, he doesn't eat anybody up, so a better translation, overwhelm. He overwhelms you. And that's what you do with a beef roast on Sunday, isn't it? You overwhelm it. Well, if it'd be holiday, I'd think it was getting overwhelmed. And so, a better translation, overwhelm. Now, why? You see, the key to this verse is, why does a lion roar? Isn't it? Isn't that the key to this verse? If we could figure out why a lion roars, we could figure out what Satan's trying to do to overwhelm you. Right? All right. Let's turn back to an Old Testament book that tells us why a lion roars. So we don't have to go to the zoo and camp out there all night. We can just go to the Bible. It's self-sufficient. Hosea, Joel, Amos, the third chapter. All right? The third chapter of Amos. It's going to tell you why a lion roars. He roars on two occasions. He roars, first of all, when he sees a prey, and to make the prey afraid, he roars. When he's killed his prey, he roars too. All right? So a lion roars for two reasons. He'll roar first to overwhelm you, and then after he's overwhelmed you, he'll roar again. All right, now let's look at it. Amos 3, verse 4. Will a lion roar in the forest if he has no prey? Obviously the answer is no. He roars when he has a prey. Now why does he roar when he has a prey? Down the 8th verse. The lion hath roared. Who will not fear? You see, a lion's pretty smart. He sees some of these fleet-footed little antelope or something out there, and there's a young one, and he roars real loud, and this little one is scared, and the rest run off. Now he doesn't have to run so far to get this one. Pretty smart, isn't it? Right? He roars to make them afraid. Then it goes on to tell you, they also roar when they've got their prey. Well, let's see. In the 4th verse, will a young lion cry out of his den if he's not taken anything? No, obviously the answer is he only cries out of his den when he's taken something. So they roar two times, once to scare the daylights out of the thing they're going to kill. Makes it easier to kill it. And then they roar after they've killed it. For us, Satan as a lion goes about seeking to overwhelm us by making us frightened and coward. You know, it's most unreasonable. I've seen fellows that would, they're just much like Peter. They'd stand up and preach to a group and tell them the truth and not cut the corners, and then they get to another place with another group and they're scared to say the same thing. And it isn't reasonable. No, it isn't. But it's certainly scriptural. Satan has attacked the fellow, and he becomes being a coward. Doesn't in spiritual things isn't sin, but again, it'll cause you to do something that's sin. See what it caused Peter to do? It caused him to lie, and in that lying, deny his Lord. Being a coward was no sin. It's when he did something while he's sinning. What did he say? Little young maid comes up to him and says, "Well, you're one of them, aren't you? By the beard of my face, I had never heard of it." Now, he cursed by using an oath. He didn't go blankety 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 blank. But he didn't cuss. He swore with an oath. Then a young man came up to him. "Why, you know him, don't you? Your speech gives you away. By the God in heaven, I don't know him." Okay. So you have cowardice, timidity, and spiritual thing. Now lying, we also say. Now lying is one of the few things that comes across straight. Satan puts it in your mind to lie, you lie. So when it comes across straight, see, cowardice doesn't come across cowardice. It's something you do while cowardice. Independence of God doesn't come across that way. It's something you do. Doubt doesn't come across doubt. It's something you do. But lying comes across straight. Satan puts it in your heart to lie, you lie. And that's sin. But putting into your heart's no sin. You say no. You don't lie. So lying comes right across. And that's Acts 5, 1 through 4. Now what do we want to say on that? If you look at John 8, some have misunderstood this. And that's why I said I wanted to come back to this. John 8, 44. It's not talking about all lying that Satan's the father of. In the original it says this. You are of your father, the devil. And by the way, the fatherhood here is by authority. You see, it's in contrast to the way God the Father is the Father of Jesus Christ. Now, God the Father is not the Father of Jesus Christ because He begat Jesus Christ. The Holy Spirit begat the humanity of Christ. So if anybody's the Father of the humanity of Christ, it's the Holy Spirit, not God the Father. But God the Father is the Father of Christ because Christ was under His authority. It was a fatherhood of authority when Christ was on earth, economic. Now he says, look, 38th verse, I speak what I've seen of my father, and you do that which you've seen of your father. See the contrast of father there. So that Satan is not the father of unsaved people because they're born of Satan. They're born again of Satan. I just got a tape from a fellow in California who wants me to evaluate scripturally because some idiot got up and said, he says you're your father of the devil, so all of them were born again of Satan. Well, no, they're father of the devil is in this verse because they are under his authority, just like Christ was under the authority of God the Father and did what God the Father wanted him to do. You look at the contrast in that chapter. You see, it's not saying like God the Father begat me and made me a human. Satan begat you. But that's what some fellow was saying. And he went on to say that Adam and Eve were born again backwards when they sinned.
Yes.
No, you're of your father, the devil. Now, it tells you why they're the father. Because they're under his authority. They haven't been born again of Satan. You're of your father, the devil, and the lust of your father you will to be doing. There's an infinitive there. It should be translated that way. You will to be doing. He was a murderer from the beginning. This is when he destroyed or spiritually killed a third of the angels of heaven. This isn't talking about Adam, because he didn't kill Adam. All right? This is from the beginning. This is before Adam was created. He abode not in the truth because there's no truth in him. When he speaketh the lie. Now this is talking about one specific identifiable lie. He speaks out of his own things. For he's a liar and the father of it. Notice the it is singular. Referring back to the lie. One lie. Not all lies. You father lies. Satan puts them in your mind and you mother or father them. Don't you see? If you do them, you're mothering your father and you bring him into the realm of reality. But this is talking about one lie. Now, I'll just give you a hint. This is what will Satan, when the Holy Spirit allows him by leaving, stopping, and restraining, that's the lie that that people will be believing in the tribulation period that go into the tribulation having heard the gospel. Turn over to 2 Thessalonians 2:11. And it says, with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them and perish, because they previously did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. For this cause God shall send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie. One specific lie that they're going to believe. And the reason they're going to believe that lie is so they'll be condemned. See the next verse? Now that's not the lie that Ananias and Sapphira fathered and mothered in the 5th chapter. Satan planted the egg, but they hatched it. Take some eggs from a whole bunch of hens and you put them under a setting hen. Who's the mother of those chickens? In nomenclature. It's the setting hen. You don't go back and get the egg from every one of the... Isn't that right? You say the hen with her chicks? I know, I was raised on a farm. We drove a hen crazy one time, put some pheasant eggs under. And when they hatched these little pheasants, they'd just go in every which way. And this poor old mother hen was just going nuts trying to collect them all together. All right, but she was the mother of some pheasants. All right, so here you have... that's not what Satan is... Satan, nobody really... Well, they do. Some have trouble with that lie, but not much today. All right, so he brings the lie. You hatch it, so you become the parent of it. You get the blame for it. If you lie, God doesn't whip Satan. He whips you. Right? Why does he whip you? Because you hatched it. So you're responsible for it being in existence. That's right. Same way if you put the eggs under the setting hen. You see, if you take the eggs and break them and cook them, there's no chicks. Now, there's another thing, and this some have said is a sin because they go back to Proverbs. There's some mistranslations of the Proverbs, by the way, in the 7 things that God hates, because it really doesn't say proud look. It says a haughty look, and it's the haughty look of a harlot that God hates back there in Proverbs. And so they say pride is a sin. No, pride isn't a sin. It's like doubt again. Pride will lead you into sin. Pride was the lust that caused Satan to sin, but that wasn't his sin. Now, I've read in 1,000 books that was his sin. No, his sin was revolting against God. You see? And let me show you. It'll help you in this. Let's look back at Ezekiel 28. I want you to see that this pride, this unrighteousness, was uncovered in Satan before he ever sinned. He sinned by actually becoming violent and revolting against God. Look at the 15th verse of Ezekiel 28. Thou were perfect in all of your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness. Now that word iniquity should be unrighteousness. Whenever you find the word iniquity, just put a question mark by it and ask somebody that knows, because iniquity is nuts. There's no such word. They've used it to translate 15 different Hebrew words. That should tell you there's no such word. All right? Till unrighteousness was found in thee. Now notice while it was still in him, what was it? Unrighteousness. All right? Now then, by the multitude of your merchandise, you filled your midst with violence, and you have sinned. See? When he became violent, sold it to a bill of goods to a bunch of others. That's what the merchandising is. He sold it as a bill of goods. Then he carried it out. Then he sinned. So pride, while it was in him, he was proud. But the pride wasn't the sin. That was the basis of what he did. He was so proud of his beauty, he says, I'm too good to be where God put me. I'm going to change my throne. I'm going to put it above God's throne. It's too good to be here. That's when he tried to move it. That God says, you've sinned. All right? Now, pride isn't sin, but it sure is a terrible thing. Now, it's in the context for pastors, because you can see why. A young pastor, and this has happened to many young pastors because they haven't followed Scripture. A little novice, you get a guy saved, they do this down south. 18-year-old kid saved. Next thing you know, they make him a pastor of 500 people. Spurgeon was like this. He was a know-nothing. At 18 years of old, began preaching. Don't tell me he knew all the Bible at 18. He didn't. He didn't know the Bible even after he died, before he died, he was reading Calvin. All right? And you can understand this. A guy just gets saved, and you put him over a bunch of people, he's open to pride. So that's why you find the warning. But it's not exclusively just pastors that get proud. Novice pastors. You see? Now let's look at 1 Timothy 3. And this is a very descriptive term. This word pride, it should be the word that's pride. We speak of it this way. That guy's got a swelled head. You ever heard that? Now that's pride. All right, now it says in 1 Timothy 3, talking about a pastor, that he should not be an amateur, an untried novice. See? Do that. Down south, they call a fellow right after he gets saved. One was one. He was saved, and they had him pastor of a big church at 18. And later, he had a little church. He couldn't stand it. He'd preaching to people. They'd walk by faith, and they tried to get him to walk by faith, and he couldn't. And he stumbled the whole church. Really, this. Sixth verse. Not a novice. Not an amateur. Not an untried beginner. So a pastor is never to be an untried beginner. If he has a pastor-teacher gift, he has to learn to use it. He has to have the material to use it. It takes while, time. But it says, not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride. Now that translation, it describes smoke. Have you seen smoke come out of a chimney? As smoke comes out of a chimney, it starts expanding and expanding and expanding. That's what this is talking about, being swell-headed, you see. You start off a little guy, and he pretty soon got a head that wide. Now, look at where it comes from. Look at the rest of the verse. Lest he fall into reproach, not sin yet, see, reproach, and a snare from the devil. Now, of the devil, that's so ambiguous, it's an ablative of sorts, from the devil. Right? It's a snare. It'll snare him. And it'll bring reproach on him. And as a result, he will sin. But it isn't sin yet. You see, it doesn't tell you that he'll sin. If it were going to be sin, it'd be fair if God say, well, it is sin. It'll bring reproach. People say, I don't want to go to that church. That guy's got such a swelled head, he doesn't know that you exist. I've heard that. And he'll fall into condemnation. He'll fall into condemnation from the devil. And so, the condemnation, moreover, must have a good report. Read ahead. It says in that verse, pride, he'll fall into condemnation from the devil. People condemn him for it, and as a result, he'll probably sin. Not God's condemnation. That's swell-headedness. That comes from Satan. It's right from Satan. It says so. All right? And so, now the unforgiving spirit. When I went to a church down in Arizona, we had two families that sat on the other side, and they'd been doing it for 10, 15 years. They sat on that side. I came in. I didn't know what was going on. I asked, why don't we all sit over on one side? Well, brother, that was stepping on toes. Come to find out, these people hadn't spoken for a long time. And one of the persons said, I can't forgive him, I can't forgive him, I can't forgive him. Now, where does that come? Well, you won't find it under the works of flesh, but if you turn to 2 Corinthians 2, you'll find it as a work of Satan. And that is just what was happening at Corinth. At Corinth, they had a man that they were sort of snickering about and said, boy, aren't we broad-minded? And they didn't kick him out in 1 Corinthians 5. Finally, when Paul got after him and made them kick him out, then they didn't realize you kick a guy out, you discipline members to get him straightened out. When they straighten out, then you want them back. But they got rid of this rascal and they said, good riddance. Paul says, no. Now let me read the verses in the context and you'll see it. Starting with fourth verse of 2 Corinthians 2. But out of much affliction and anguish of heart I wrote unto you with many tears, not that you should be grieved, but that you might know the love which I have more abundantly unto you. But if any have caused grief, he has not grieved me, but in part. And Paul says, the guy that is causing you grief, he caused me grief in part, but I've forgiven him. That's why it's only in part, that I may not be overcharged of you all. Sufficient to such a man is this punishment which was inflicted of many. Now that refers back to 1 Corinthians 5, when the whole church gathered together and kicked the guy out. All right? He says that punishment was sufficient, so don't keep it up. So that contrarywise, you ought to forgive him and comfort him, lest such a one should be swallowed up with overmuch sorrow. Now the guy had repented, changed his manner of life, and yet they weren't going to take him back. And the guy says, what do I got to do to get back? See? Church discipline is to get straightened out, not to get rid of. Now if they won't straighten out, then obviously you don't take them back. The church discipline, not to get rid of them, it's to get them straightened out. If they won't straighten out, obviously, then they can't come back. This guy got straightened out. Now he says, wherefore I beseech you that you confirm your love toward him. To this end also I did write, that I might know the proof of you, whether you be obedient in all things. To whom ye forgive anything, I forgive also. For if I forgave anything, to whom I forgave it, for your sakes I forgave it in the person of Christ, lest Satan should get an advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of the things of the working of the mind from him. Now what's Paul saying? If I refuse to forgive this guy, which I have done, then Satan would have an advantage over me. Because he had put something in my mind. And in this context, what did he put in mind? Unforgiving spirits. Yeah. Unforgiving spirit. He's trying to warn these Corinthians. The reason now they got the guy out, they're not going to take him back. They won't forgive him. The guy's straightened out. He's gotten everything made right. Now you forgive him and show love toward him. But they weren't going to do it. They were going to be just like those two families.